Oakley Show podcast is on the rails. On this episode, initially, there was a rush to dismiss those who suggested COVID-19 could have originated in a lab in Wuhan. If you suggested as much, you'd be denigrated as a conspiracy theorist. But there's now a growing league of scientists whose research shows the virus may not have jumped directly from bats to people. We talked to one such individual out in California. From there, down to Alabama, where we explore a bit of country music history with one of the organizers of the annual Hank Williams Music Festival. And then over to Arkansas, where the victim of a robbery in 1981 is begging the state's governor to show mercy to the man who robbed him all those years ago, and for which a judge slapped him with a life sentence in prison. And that's not all. There's a lot more in the hopper today. But before all that, we start here. June 8, 1972. That a napalm attack maybe changed the course of the Vietnam War. There was a picture that was taken of a 9-year-old girl running naked down a village street along with other villagers in sheer terror and as a consequence of a napalm attack. And therein begins the story of Kim Phuc Van Thi. And Kim has joined us on the line to explain how all these years later, her life has come to, I guess, a point in Ajax, Ontario, where it's met several challenges over the years. And of course, she's overcome them and is in a much, much happier place. Kim, I appreciate you joining the Oakley Show. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Kim, by the way, this date, based on, you know, the fact that it's a historical marker of note, I mean, does it still have any relevance in your life, this particular date?
Yeah, this is June 8, 1972, that you mean?
Yes.
That happened, yes. And, of course, I always remember that day. That day is the day that I will never forget. And the day it changed my life forever. And yes, I remember we hiding in the Tao Dai Temple. And so at the lunch time is exactly today, June 8, 1972. And so we as the children, we play around the bomb shelter, and then the soldiers started to yell for the children and ask all the children run out of the temple. Then we run first, and I was one of them, and then the others running after the children with belonging, with the baby. And then I was in the middle of them, between the children and adults. Then I just got into Highway 1. So I saw the airplane just was so fast towards to me. And then I stood right there, and I looked at the airplane, and I saw 4 bombs landing down, and I heard the noise, boop, boop. Then suddenly I saw the fire everywhere around me. And then, of course, my clothes was burned off by the fire, and I saw the fire over my left arm, and I used my right hand. I took it off. And then I got burned all over. Then I was so terrified, and I was so scared. And I remember my thought, oh my goodness, I got burned, and I would be ugly, and so the people will see me different way. But at that moment, I was so terrified, and then I ran out of that fire, and I saw my brothers, and I saw my cousin, and some soldiers there. And then we kept running and running on Highway 1 for a while. And I still remember that. And then when I was so tired to run anymore, then I stopped. Then I called out, too hot, too hot. Then some, you know, the soldiers were there. They tried to help me. They gave me some water to drink. And they poured the water over me. Then at that moment, I passed out. I didn't know anything else. That day happened to me. And yeah, the rest, I just learned the story from the people who were there to tell me. Their story became my story.
It's become a fantastic story. I mean, 49 years ago on this date, again, 9-year-old Kim Phuc Phan Thi was obviously burned by napalm in this celebrated picture that was on the front page of the New York Times. It won a Pulitzer Prize for its photographer, Nick Utz. Nick Utz, by the way, you stayed in touch with him for a long time. Are you still in touch with the photographer who took that fateful picture?
Actually, I didn't remember his face. I heard about him, but 17 years later, I met him again. And at that time, I was in Cuba, so he went to Cuba. We met each other there.
You know, Kim, it's fascinating to me how when you survived this napalm attack and this picture, I mean, there's a story of it started another chapter or several other chapters in your life. Mind you, at 9 years of age, you were young at the time, but then, you know, you're not lost to history. There's a story attached to it, how you said you ended up in Cuba. Initially, I guess you were used as propaganda by the North Vietnamese and taken out of medical school. How'd you end up in Cuba then?
Because they interrupted my school, and it was so hard for me as a student. And I met the prime minister. At that time, I begged him, please let me go somewhere quiet to finish my studies. Then it seemed like he listened to me, and shortly after he arranged for me to go to Cuba to study. And I end up, I went to University of Havana in 1986.
And then subsequent to that, when you came out of Cuba, I mean, tell us how you went from Cuba to get to Canada, where you're now living in Ajax, Ontario.
That is a wonderful story. Actually, until 1992, I studied in Cuba about 6 years. Then I got married. Then the government gave us the permission to go honeymoon. Only place is Moscow. And during that time, I heard the rumors that our airplane, we stopped over in Gander, Newfoundland, for refueling just for 1 hour in Gander, Newfoundland, Canada. So at that time, that place, that is our chance, our opportunity to escape, to have freedom. So even I didn't know anything about Canada, but I seeking for freedom, and I stay over. I'm not going back to my airplane, go back to Cuba. So we stay in Canada in October 15, 1992, in Gander, Newfoundland. Yes, and I'm so thankful for Canadian government and the people Canadian who open to help me to have a new life, to have freedom. And I'm so thankful for that. I never take it for granted, and I dedicated my life to contribute to the country, to the people. This is my family, you know. It's wonderful.
Well, it's interesting that you remember that date specifically, October 15th, because, again, another milestone in your incredible journey. And as you say, you're dedicating your life and giving back. I understand you started a foundation. What's the objective or the purpose of your foundation now at this point?
Yes, our mission is to help the children who are affected by war or violence around the world. And we focus on building with, we partners with another foundation to build a school, to build a hospital, and we help orphanage children, and we build a library for children. That's our focus.
And some of that impetus, too, comes from your becoming a Christian, as I understand it. Even in your darkest days, suddenly you found there was a turning point or some light at the end of a dark tunnel, and that was in adopting Christianity. At what point did that happen?
Because, yes, what happened in 1982, I got into medicine school. Then a Vietnamese government rediscover me, and then they picked me up from my school to do a lot of interviews and filming, and finally they cut short my study. Then you can imagine my life. My dream was to become a doctor, and then I couldn't go to school anymore. And that was a really low point in my life. I didn't know how to do. And because as a teenager, then no school is not right. But I didn't know how to do. It is so hard. And then I just seeking and looking for the answer. Why me? What the purpose in my life? Why I have to suffer that much? And it seemed to me like I became another kind of victim. Then I spent my time in the library to searching, reading all kind of religious books, to find the purpose for my life and what the true. And then among the book that I read the New Testament. And then the more I read, the more question I had. because I was raised in the Kaldai religion. So eventually, I found all the answer in the Bible. And then later in Christmas 1982, I became Christian. My faith in God is just my rock, and it's essential for my happiness and my values. And I'm so thankful for that faith in Jesus, and I learn how to love my enemies, how I forgive them, and you know, I started to work on that, and I pray for my enemies, and it means like I love my enemies, right? And eventually, my heart feel completely forgiveness, and that after the real forgiveness I experiences, is my heart set free. And it is heaven on earth for me, for that little girl. I am so thankful for that. And from there, I move on. I learned that I tell what I have, but I don't tell what I lost, you know.
That's remarkable.
Is a great. Yeah, thank you.
It's a remarkable life's journey, Kim, I've got to say. And, you know, all of the challenges based on, you know, your injuries there from the napalm attack 49 years ago today in South Vietnam and 17 operations. I mean, it was just really horrific. I mean, your life was saved, I guess, effectively in a clinic in West Germany. But now you're in Ajax, Ontario, and your health finally, is it everything okay? I mean, are there any more, you know, repercussions or, you know, results, consequences of that napalm day?
Yes. I had been suffered a lot with the pain, not only as the moment when I got burned, but for many, many years after that. Mm. And about 5 years ago, I had been with a treatment, laser treatment in Miami. I went through 11 laser treatment, all of my skin, my scar, and now I got much better, like released my pain about halfway. I am so thankful for that, yeah.
Much to be thankful for. It's a remarkable life's journey, as I said, and I really appreciate you're coming on and sharing it with us on this date, certainly significant, 49 years ago, the napalm attack on South Vietnam. Again, Kim Phuc Van Thi, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, and continue to enjoy, I guess, you know, life in Canada, and your great attitude towards things is really one of those uplifting stories. Very, very important to share that kind of message, I believe. And I thank you again. All the best going forward.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, you have a good day again. Kim Phuc Van Thi. From time to time, we like to delve into what I call the human condition, and it's a rather fascinating row to hoe, and I'm not alone in that regard. There's a gentleman down in Florida who's also made this part of his beat, and he's got a podcast to that effect. What Was That Like? Is the brainchild of Scott Johnson, host of that same podcast. And so let's find out. Scott Johnson, I believe, has joined us on the line here to explain what the Dickens got this started and where's he going with all of this and who are some of the fascinating people that he's encountered. Scott, are you there?
I am here, John. Good to be with you.
Good to have you on board, Scott. I appreciate you joining us here. So listen, I mean, I get it. This is human condition stuff, which is my bailiwick, I like to say. So we're sort of kindred spirits here, fellow travelers. But how'd you choose to get into this as a podcast thing? I mean, what was it? What was the trigger point?
Well, I found that, I mean, I started podcasting back in 2012. And so I started listening to podcasts. And every once in a while, there would be a podcast that where someone would come on and tell a story. And even better, if it was a true story of something really unusual. And I found that those were the podcast episodes that I really enjoyed. And I wanted to have more of that. And I looked around and I couldn't see any other podcasts doing that on a consistent basis. So I already knew how to podcast. So I figured, okay, I'll make it myself. So I just started making a list of people and situations that that I would personally find interesting. And so I would assume other people would find them interesting as well.
All right. So you recognize the good story and you go and recruit these people and you sit them down usually and you just have them at some length go into, I guess, their in-depth story. Tell us about some of the stories that you've covered that perhaps you found to be, well, surprising and most fascinating.
Well, actually, the fact that a story is fascinating is one of the criteria for it to even get on the podcast. So I like all of them, but some of the ones that are unusual are people that have survived a mass shooting, people who have survived a plane crash. One man got bitten by a rattlesnake. Somebody else got on, went on Shark Tank and got a deal with Mark Cuban. You know, they're not all tragedy stories, but one lady discovered her husband's suicide. And, you know, a lot of these stories like this, you might see them on the news briefly. You know, they go for a 20-minute interview and they edit that down and you hear 3 minutes of it at 6 o'clock. But that's not what I want to do. I want to really get inside their head and think, and I want them to tell me, you know, what was going through your head when this was happening? These are pretty traumatic events for a lot of people. One guy was a young man was hit by a truck. And a lot of these episodes also include the actual 911 audio that was made from the scene.
And yeah, I was curious about that.
Right there.
Yes, Scott, how do you recruit that? How do you get a hold of that footage, as it were?
There's a variety of ways, and it really depends on the jurisdiction. But in general, it's in the United States, it's a Freedom of Information fact that 911 audio calls are public information. Now, local jurisdictions can restrict who they give that to, like maybe only family members or something like that. But for a lot of them, you know, you just contact the police department or the records department and request it. Maybe there's a fee involved. Sometimes there's not. And they send it to you.
Again, Scott Johnson's with us, host of the podcast. What was that like? It's a very interesting open-ended question. But to your point, when you're talking to these people, they're all sharing something that's extraordinary as way of experience that maybe the common folk have never experienced, like being shot. I've never been in a tsunami, for example, or even been on Wheel of Fortune in one. So these are some of the litany of people that you've talked to, and they share that experience. And it's a great insight into part of what I guess makes it unique, and it's a longer form too, because as the news might cover it in a, you know, scant 20, 30 second clip, you're delving into it, what, 30 minutes on average at a clip?
Oh, usually longer than that. I want it to be at least 30 minutes, but a few have gone over an hour. And you know, on a podcast, I'm not limited by when we have to start and stop. It can, as long as it takes them to tell the story, that's how long the show will be.
Well, here's a couple of for instances. I mean, I made some notes and I'm just kind of curious because I mean, we tend to do a similar type of fare, although I've never talked to somebody who survived a tsunami. And according to the individual who did in Thailand back, oh, I guess what was that, about 20 years ago now?
Yeah, it was 2004, I believe.
Yeah, okay, not quite what you think it would be. How was it fascinating in terms of what he related to you?
He had a unique vantage point, and there were so many, that whole, you really have to listen to the episode to get all the details of it, but he and his wife had gone over there to Thailand to spend for a month-long trip, and he went hiking one day. She stayed back at the hotel. He went hiking with a friend, and they were on a sort of a cliff, an overhang, and while they were up there, they could see this wave coming in, and the guy that he was with was a local, and the guy said, well, I thought this isn't a tidal area. What's the wave that's coming in? And that guy had no idea. So he knew something was very wrong. And so they were at a vantage point. They saw the whole thing come in and wash up on, and take out buildings and boats and everything. But they were high enough up that they weren't affected by it. Hmm. And then, of course, after that, they came down and saw all the devastation. And he went looking for his wife. And I don't want to have any spoilers to tell you that, but he actually did find his wife, so it's a happy ending.
All right. We're always good with a happy ending. Scott Johnson, again, host of the podcast.
Yes.
What was that like? Here's one that intrigued me. I haven't had a chance to delve into it, but the guy, Dan, who biked to the South Pole, he biked to the South Pole. Can you share some insight there?
Oh, man. Yes, this is. I've always been fascinated by human endurance. I've done a few ultramarathons myself, and just the capability of the human body to sustain effort over time, especially being alone and being in frigid temperatures where, I mean, he could look 360 degrees and see nothing but snow and ice. And he was out there all by himself. And I think it was like 40 days or 45 days that it took him. And there were times when he couldn't ride the bike. He had to actually push the bike through big snow drifts, And but he made it. He was the first one to bike to the South Pole. So that was an interesting story for him to tell.
Well, survival, human endurance. There are a couple of here that deal with that, specifically Dan, mauled by a grizzly bear, Kira attacked by a serial rapist. I mean, what was the deal with Kira being attacked by a serial rapist?
She was walking to work. She had to be to work very early. So she was walking at around 3 a.m. On a Portland, Oregon street, which some would say that's probably not too smart anyway, but she felt very comfortable and she'd done it before. But she was approached and molested. And the thing about that is I was able to get the audio of the phone call that she was making as she desperately ran from her attacker. And just hearing the desperation in her voice, I mean, you just want to reach through the speakers and give her a hug, you know. But she made it out.
Yeah. And Dan, mauled by a grizzly bear, that can't be a pleasant experience.
Oh, my goodness. And Dan was he's an avid outdoorsman. He lives in Alaska, and he had even had bear encounters before. So he knew how to react and what to do and the safety precautions. But this one, he and his friend and his dog had inadvertently gotten between this grizzly and her cubs, and he wasn't aware of that at the time. But, he what a storyteller. You got to hear that one. It's.
I was going to say, Scott, you've archived all of these things alphabetically, and so they're there for those who want to check out the podcast. What was that like? You know, I've got to ask you, I mean, what was it like? Shiny ate his own foot. I mean, I don't know what this is about, but it's something that, you know, it sounds like he's a contortionist of the first order. What happened with Shiny?
Well, yeah, whenever people ask, sometimes the question I get asked is, what's the weirdest episode you've ever done? And that's the one. Shiny ate his own foot. This was a man who had a group of friends, and at times they would talk and joke around. And one time the question came up, what if you had the opportunity to taste human flesh and it was legal and it was ethical and even if it was healthy? So would you do it? And most of them said, yeah, sure, why not? I would do that, knowing that obviously it's never going to happen. Well, not long after that, Shiny had a motorcycle accident and he had to have his foot amputated. And when he got out of the hospital, he asked, can I have my foot? And they had it in the refrigerator, and he had to sign some disclaimers, some papers and things, but he was able to get his foot back. So he got back home, and he started making phone calls to his friends saying, hey, remember what we talked about before? What do you think? You want to do it? And surprisingly, they agreed to it. He had about 10 people over, and one of his friends is a chef, and they had what's called foot tacos. So... they could say that they've done it.
Wow. Which makes it doubly fascinating. As much as these people are rather interesting, that one's right over the top. I'm just curious. Shiny wasn't killed by Jennifer. That was your first guest, wasn't it? She killed a motorcyclist. It's interesting because these personal accounts, they're cathartic. Sometimes you almost, I'm guessing, feel like you're their confessor as well as whatever. And so in that case, was it, I mean, a lot of guilt, remorse, all the rest of these human emotions that were, you know, replete in that story? What was the deal with Jennifer?
Yeah, that was my very first episode on this podcast, and I was so fortunate to be able to get that story. She was with her two young girls and was driving and had pulled into an intersection at night, didn't see the motorcycle approaching from her left, and he ran into her. And I was able to get the 911 audio, that the call that she made from the scene as she's kneeling there in the road with him while her two little girls are still in the car. And she hadn't even heard it. It was about a year and a half after it had happened, or 2 years, when I spoke with her. And she had to have her therapist listen to the episode first and kind of prepare her for what she was going to hear. But yeah, I mean, there's so much to talk about after the aftermath of that. You know, was she going to be prosecuted criminally? What about the finances of having a lawyer represent you, having to explain to your little kids that mommy might have to go to prison, and not to mention the guilt even though it was determined to be not her fault, she wasn't liable in it. But there's so much to unpack there as she, I mean, she experienced PTSD herself, and as well as grief. And she didn't even know this man, but yet she found that she was grieving for him and for his family.
Yeah, it's an insight into the human condition for sure. As I said at the outset, 8 million stories in the Naked City. You've chronicled a bunch of them here as a part of your podcast that continues on unabated. What was that like, including Ramon's wife hired a hitman to kill him? Did you talk to Ramon or the wife?
I talked to Ramon. His wife is in prison.
Okay.
But yeah, that's a really interesting one because he found out from a friend that she had tried to hire someone to kill him because they were in the process of getting a divorce and she didn't want 50-50. She wanted everything. And she hired someone, but then it turns out that she hired an undercover police officer, which seems like happens all the time. But they had to fake his death in order for her to believe that he was actually dead. So they dug a grave and put makeup on him, and as if he was in the grave with a bullet in his head, and showed it to her. And then of course they arrested her, and now she's in prison.
Doing hard time. What a great story. Yeah. They're all great stories. Geez, we've just scratched the surface here this afternoon, but needless to say, you can subscribe to the podcast. It's there on Apple or Spotify. What was that like? Scott Johnson is the host of SAID. There are so many components to this whole COVID-19 thing. We talked about all of the backlog in surgeries and procedures. 16 million, according to the Ontario Medical Association. So you can see the disruption that has been caused, needless to say, of course, the deaths and so on and so forth with COVID-19. But really at the heart of it is whether or not we have had the complete story when it comes to its origins. And that's been much contested too. As a matter of fact, it's been somewhat dismissed as being fanciful that this could have leaked from a lab in Wuhan. And yet now there is more credence being lent to that point of view. As a matter of fact, the President of the United States has even asked the national intelligence community to redouble efforts to investigate. So what is going on? By way of perhaps a tease or a hint, there's been an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal, reprinted in the National Post, that suggests, in fact, there are markers that show this was, in fact, a lab leak. Richard Mueller is a professor of physics emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, as well as a former senior scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and co-author of this op-ed piece that I've cited in the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Mueller, good to have you here on the Oakley Show in Toronto. I appreciate you joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You know, when the president has, as you say, asked the national intelligence community to redouble efforts to investigate the origins, just first off, tell us why it's important to determine said origins.
Well, the virus appeared was particularly dangerous to humans. It spread very rapidly, unprecedented. It seemed to be adapted to humans from the very beginning. Extremely, extremely dangerous. It makes no sense from our history of knowing similar things back in 2003 with the SARS epidemic, which was also a coronavirus. In 2012, we had the MERS, M-E-R-S virus, also a coronavirus. But they weren't nearly as virulent. They didn't spread as quickly. They had to mutate before they were adapted. This one came out running, and it was devastating. From the very beginning, there was a worry that this had been developed at the Wuhan laboratory. And if that's the case, if it was developed in a laboratory, then there are serious implications, because it would mean that China was in violation of the Biological Warfare Convention, which says you're not supposed to do any such secret work without complete openness. And if they were doing such work, then why were they doing it? And why were they keeping it secret? It bodes ill for the future if these things can be developed in the laboratory, and we know they can be, And if someone is allowed to do that, if some country is allowed to do that, that's exceedingly dangerous for the future. I don't imagine World War III is going to be a war in which we bomb people. It'll be an economic war in which countries are trying to make get economic advantage. And this thing has shown, even though I believe it was released by accident, that it can give enormous economic advantage to one country over another.
Interesting. All right. And so, as you cited, this accidental release, the Wuhan lab leak theory, as it were, you do posit in your piece that credence is lent to that whole notion, the theory, by science itself. And we're told, you know, trust the science, follow the science. So how has the science then directed us in this regard to lead you to conclude that?
Well, if you follow the science, you say there are two alternative theories. One is the natural release. You ask for the evidence for that, and a year and a half ago, there's all sorts of scientific evidence, but all of that evidence has been withdrawn. It was false evidence. It was false news. China had said things that turned out not to be true. You ask, what is the physical evidence in terms of the natural release? And there is none today. For the lab release, there's all sorts of indirect evidence, but the virus itself contains very unusual features that we have been unable to explain away in any natural way. There's a particular part of the virus that can break into the human cell and infect it in a way that this piece that was put in there contains a code in it, which we call the double sig code, and exactly what that is less important. But the fact is the double sig code has been used at the Wuhan laboratory in the past. It's been built into viruses in the past for experimental reasons. It's been used about a dozen times around the world by scientists who are doing experiments trying to see whether the virus would become more potent. But it doesn't exist naturally in the whole class of coronaviruses that COVID belongs to. The idea that these 12 different sequences all could have come about naturally through mutation is inconceivable. The odds of that are a billion to one. And yet this was the very sequence that had been used by the Wuhan lab and inserted into other viruses. So it just looks like it was inserted in. And that's one of the two science clues that is really hard to convert in country to argue against.
All right. Just to reiterate, so I understand it clearly, what you're saying is the genomic sequence, gene splicing is in evidence here, and it doesn't occur naturally in any of these other coronaviruses that have been studied heretofore. And so it's unprecedented, which would lead one to, and does it have no ability or capacity to generate this sequence on its own? It's got to find it in nature as well. So therefore, we would lead
that's important. That's very important, and there are gene swappings that take place in nature, but none of the coronaviruses in this whole class have this sequence in it. It's a 12-step sequence, and the idea that it came about from chance is minuscule. But there's something else, and that is that this virus, unlike the MERS virus, unlike the SARS virus, when it started to spread, these other viruses adapted themselves to humans. They would keep on mutating. And then the ones that mutated successfully and were more virulent, those are the ones that survived. So over the first few months of those previous diseases, those viruses were optimizing themselves. This one underwent almost no mutation in its whole lifetime. There was finally a minor mutation in the UK. But nothing important. It was pre-optimized. Now, that can be done in the laboratory, and it is done in the laboratory. It's called gain-of-function processing. And what you do in the laboratory is you basically accelerate evolution. You get mice, have the same receptors in them. These are humanized mice. If the virus evolves to attack the mice, it will attack humans. And by running it through the mice over and over and over and over again, you can get a virus that is basically pre-adapted. Now, when this virus started hitting the people in Wuhan, it didn't mutate any further. We've looked at it. We've looked at what sort of mutations could be done. it's been very hard to find any mutation that could make it even more effective. As I said, one finally did occur in the UK, but even its effectiveness was not very significant. So the fact that this is pre-adapted is another clue. It's another fingerprint, a scientific evidence that this thing underwent gain of function processing. And that should not have been allowed. That should not, against the treaty, against the biological warfare treaty, the Wuhan laboratory should not have done that without complete openness. And as you know, openness has been the opposite of what they've been doing. They've been hiding everything, not allowing people to get over there and inspect, not allowing us to talk to their scientists.
Well, when you say pre-adapted, I mean, and you talked about humanized mice, you know, same genetic makeup, but, you know, because they're laboratory mice, I mean, we're free to experiment with them. Could that have happened within bats or pangolins or anything else? In other words, it was kind of like percolating within, and then, boom, right away, jump to humans in that evolved form?
There are other ways it could have happened, but they're all speculative, and none of them have any evidence. So there was just a study in China of 80,000 other animals in which they were looking for such possible jumps. I like to stick to the evidence. Now, you can always speculate, and even odds of one in a billion, well, things that are once in a billion, we can say that the odds that I would be talking to you right now are one in a billion, and hey, it's happening. So yes, odd things can happen, but in science, but you have to evaluate our competing hypotheses and look at the evidence. And if you say it's natural, there should be some evidence for that. But every time they've looked for evidence, they haven't found any. Initially, the Chinese announced they had lots of evidence, but when we look at it closely, there was no evidence there. They even admit now they have no evidence. So initial scientists had said, you've got to trust the Chinese. They say they have evidence. And so a year and a half ago, everybody was saying it was clearly natural. Scientists wrote papers in Nature Medicine, they wrote papers in The Lancet, both saying that there's no evidence, that the Chinese evidence is strong, but the Chinese evidence crumbled. Right now, if you compare the two hypotheses, there is multiple strong evidence, scientific evidence, in favor of the lab leak hypothesis, and evidence for the natural origin. Every hypothesis where that has so far crumbled for lack of evidence. They haven't found it. So you can still hypothesize. Maybe it's possible. As I said, the odds that you and I should be talking right now are one in a billion, but we're doing it. So it is conceivable, but from scientific analysis, it is far more probable that this was a laboratory accident rather than it being natural.
Professor Mueller, what really intrigues and bewilders me at the same time is why, as you cited, all these definitive conclusions that were arrived at very early on, and even in prestigious journals like Nature Medicine back in March of 2020, given early days, NPR also had a study in this, and so on, and they all more or less decried that this could have originated in a lab, and they were willing to accept. I mean, what is that all about? I mean, has science been hampered by politics or agendas, or what is playing out there?
It was misinformation. I think if you talk to those same scientists today and gave them the following facts: one, that the claims China made that they had identified the source of it, that it was bats in the wet market, that they had definitely said that was the case, that turned out to be false. So tell these scientists that fact. Secondly, let them know that the genome that was published by the scientists, the expert scientists, the woman, Xi Zheng Li, that publication was not giving the full genome. It only gave part of it. And within a month or two after that, there were other publications showing that the critical parts have been left out, and it's those critical parts that contain these signatures. Tell those scientists that and see if they would write that letter again. I think both the Lancet letter and the Nature Medicine letter would not be written by those scientists today, knowing what we know. So those letters have been enormously influential, but they were written based on false information. And I'm not the one who's saying it's false. Everybody says it was false. This is even the Chinese say it was false. So I'm not giving any, Dr. Quay and I did not present anything really new. All we did is say, let's focus in on the science, and here are things that are well established, and recognize the fact, which nobody mentions, that there is no experimental evidence in support of the natural origin of this. None. That really changes the picture.
It really does, and I appreciate the enlightenment and bringing us up to date on the file. A fascinating account. Richard Muller, professor of physics emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, as well as former senior scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Joining us on the line is Gerald Hodges. Gerald is with the organizers of the annual Hank Williams Festival down there in Alabama. Gerald, how you doing this afternoon?
Doing great. How are you folks up there?
We're all right. Listen, so your annual Hank Williams Festival took place last week, didn't it?
Yes, yes.
How'd that go?
3-day show. Went great. We had some great entertainers and, lots of great Hank Williams music. And then basically what we would call, old style, old fashioned, not modern country music. But great music.
Traditional.
Right.
Right. Well, you know what? I mean, he's still a legend, and the legacy lives on after all these years. I mean, he died relatively young, 29 years of age, but boy, he left, as I say, a whole catalog of memorable tunes that people are still covering, Lovesick Blues, Hey Good Looking, Cold Cold Heart, and so on and so forth. But it was on this date we were trying to, pin this down to a date that was significant, and Hank made his Grand Ole Opry debut in 49. How and why was that significant? Because it didn't come about rather easily for Hank.
Be very honest with you, I was not even aware of it.
Oh.
we do not regard that as really as a monumental date. I mean, he went to Nashville, but he had a greatness before he ever arrived in Nashville. He played over in the state of Louisiana, the Louisiana Hayride, a town called Shreveport. This was a very big venue, as big as the Grand Ole Opry.
Right.
Had they been able to keep their entertainers, it would probably have been much better and much greater. But he had tremendous popularity before he went to the Grand Ole Opry. There was some concern by the opera organizers and the powers that be that did not want to bring Hank to the opera because of his drinking and sometimes of his behavior. And it was probably 2 years. It was just public outcry to bring him there. And that was why they brought him. But he was just as popular probably in the South as before he went to the Grand Ole Opry as he was when he made his appearance on this day in 1949.
Right. Well, you know, what you're saying is true. As I understand, the Louisiana Hayride, it was kind of competing with the Grand Ole Opry in terms of radio exposure and, regional popularity. I think Dolly Parton also played there, and Elvis may have at the Louisiana Hayride. That being said, though, Hank Williams, the reason he wasn't allowed to play the Opry originally was because of his drinking. How bad was his drinking, and what was his drink of choice, by the way?
It's very difficult. He did have a drinking problem, but I have talked with many of his old band members. We had one band member named Clint Holmes that played guitar for Hank. He started for Hank in 1947, and he played for him until he went to the Grand Ole Opry, until they called. And the reason that he didn't play for him on the Opry is the people in Nashville felt as though they wanted to get a better band than what he had at the present. But Clint drove his car, Packard limousine, and he never saw this with Hank. He said that Hank was one of the best people that you could ever meet, said he would look you up on payday to pay you.
Wow.
And I also talked with Ray Price, who Hank lived with after he and Audrey separated and divorced in Nashville, and with Don Helms, a steel guitar player. these people knew him up through probably the end of 1951 or were closely associated with him. But there was just a combination of health and drinking problems. When the opera decided to call him, it was pretty evident they did not know about, you know, his physical problems, that it was just the drinking that they associated with the difficulty of bringing him to the opera.
Yeah, well, he passed at 29, the tender age of 29. I guess it was late 52 at the age, from alcohol-induced heart failure. So obviously the drinking, you know, even though he might have kept it from other people, seem to have claimed him. You know what I'm impressed by? Listening to his songs, I mean, the yodeling style. Now, he took that from Jimmy Rogers, did he not? I mean, it was an earlier precursor. Jimmy was one of the greats in the 20s and 30s in country music.
He listened to Jimmy Rogers. Hank was one of these people that, I'm not going to say he drew inspiration, but inspiration came through him. Like any kind of a great leader, whether it be a preacher or a national figure, things just came out of Hank. It's like you might say, Hank was used. The music came through him. The people in the South needed something like Hank's music. We had just come out of a Great Depression in the late 30s. And Hank's songs were soulful, they were mournful, they're sad. They reached the sad emotional part of you. But that's the way a lot of people were in this area. That's why he was so popular. He touched the people, but this something came out of him. I don't think Hank was able to just say, well, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. I think he went through a lot of pain and a lot of trauma from the time he was small. And he was constantly, you know, I think, trying to find the light. And there's a story goes that when he lived in Montgomery, they had been traveling to Nashville. And they were coming back to Montgomery. And about 20 miles north of Montgomery is a little town called Prattville. And in Montgomery was the Maxwell Air Force Base. And they had a beacon for the airplanes. And Hank was coming back to Montgomery after being in Nashville, and he saw this beacon. And immediately the song, I Saw the Light, came to him. And he wrote that in the car. By the time they traveled the 20 miles to Montgomery, he basically had this song. It had to be revised, but that's the way he made some of his music, or the way the words came out of him.
Yeah, authentic to the max. Wish we had more time, but boy, I just appreciate you shedding a little light yourself here on Hank Williams and his legacy. We just thought we'd root it in this date back in 49 when he appeared at the Grand Ole Opry, but as you say, he predated that in terms of his regional stardom down there with the Louisiana Hayride. The case of Rolf Castell, who back in 1981, dig this, in Arkansas, Fort Smith, robbed a taco hut with a water pistol of $264. Still in prison. As a matter of fact, he was sentenced almost 40 years ago to this date. It was actually June 5th, 1981. But he's still in prison in Utah now and continues to languish there. And the individual who was the taco hut employee at the time who handed the money out of the till now regrets, or at least is trying to get Mr. Castell out of the joint because he believes this is beyond some kind of reasonable incarceration. Dennis Schluterman is the man who was working as a store clerk back in 81. As I say, now pleading with the Arkansas governor to show mercy. Dennis Schluterman, good to have you on the Oakley Show in Toronto. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
I appreciate you coming on. I mean, how do we reason that this individual is doing 40-plus years for robbery? I get it, armed robbery, $264, but it seems like it's excessive punishment. How do you see it?
Well, I see it just as that, excessive punishment. You know, for the crime that he did, it's aggravated robbery. I don't see anything that was aggravated about it. You know, the man came in there just as calm as could be, showed me a gun butt in his, you know, his behind his jacket. And asked me if I knew what that was and what I needed to do, and I did, and I handed him the money, and they walked out just as calm as could be. So, but they got him for aggravated robbery, which I don't think should have been in the first place. But it's just an unjust. You know, 40 years. I mean, come on.
Well, how did you feel at the time? I mean, I know it's 40 years looking in the rearview mirror, but were you feeling threatened at the time that, you know, he could have maybe taken your life? You didn't know at the time, I'm guessing, that it was a water pistol, right?
No. Like I said, he had it down in between his behind his pants, you know, in his pants or whatever, just the gun butt showing, and all of just the butt, and that's all I saw. And, you know, I was 17 at the time, and I wasn't afraid or anything like that. I was just thought I was doing the right thing, which, you know, I really was, you know, but I really didn't do much of anything. I couldn't positively identify the guys, you know, when they brought them back up to the taco hut, but they found the money, you know, in the back seat of the car. And somebody gave me a description of the car while they were parked up the road from where they robbed me at. And one of the state troopers, you know, they came to a service station here off of the interstate, right across the street from the state trooper's office. And when they were leaving, the state trooper was pulling out and had a description of the car and pulled them over. But, you know, during the robbery, I didn't feel threatened in any way. And I just, you know, like I said, I was 17, and I just thought I was doing the right thing, which, you know, I didn't know what else to do.
Well, you handed over $264, which is what most employees are told to do anyway in that case. But still, you followed this case then for the last 40-plus years. And why did you have a keen interest in keeping apprised or keeping tabs on what was happening to the Perpierre Rolfe case, Dell?
Well, after the trial, you know, I heard that he got life imprisonment. But, you know, like I said, I was young, and things were just starting to happen in my life. And I basically forgot about it, you know, until one day I was over at my parents' house, and my mom said, "Hey, I need to give you these. You know, these came in for you," and they were from Rolfe while he was in prison. And I read those letters, and you talk about emotional, you know. The man apologized to me and just on and on about, you know, how sorry he was about it. And you know, it really, that's what really got me right there. So I wrote him back and actually apologized to him, because, you know, I didn't think he'd still be in prison this long. And, you know, that was like 25 years ago. So, you know, ever since then, there's really not much, you know, me, one person can do, but this filmmaker, Kelly Duda, who also made the video about Factor 8, which, you know, has a lot to do with Canada and stuff like that, if you've ever seen that video about the blood scandal. But yeah, Kelly Duda really, he interviewed Rolfe, you know, and ever since then, he got a hold of me, and ever since then, we've been trying to get him out.
Yeah, let me just sort of clarify what that point was, because this story has another dimension to it. When we've got Rolfe Castell given 40 years plus a $15,000 fine for aggravated robbery of the taco hut back in 1981, where our guest on the line here, Dennis Schluterman, was a 17-year-old employee who he robbed that day, handed over $264 from the till. Turns out it was a water pistol, but he got life in prison plus the fine. Turns out while he's in prison, he was a whistleblower of sorts, because there was a blood plasma operation taking place where in the prisons, the inmates would collect the blood plasma for these private companies that would then sell them around the world to thousands of victims. And it was tainted blood, and some of it made its way into Canada, and where people died. Thousands of people died from this tainted blood. It was a tainted blood scandal, as you might recall. But not to jump too far ahead, then this is the film that was made of that case in the prison system, in the American prison system, Factor 8, the Arkansas prison blood scandal. They removed him and they put him in a prison in Utah. Is it your contention then, Dennis, that maybe because he was a whistleblower, he's being punished and they've got him in the system and they won't let him out now because he was, you know, he blew the whistle on this big scandal that has cost numerous lives as well as millions and millions of dollars at stake here? Do you think part of that is in play here?
Well, you know, I couldn't have said it any better myself with what you just said. I think that has a lot to do in play because of the people that were involved in this, and they basically sent him to Utah and threw away the keys, you know, on this man's life. And if it wasn't from Kelly Duda continuing on with this, you know, after the Factor 8 video and, you know, realized, you know, this wasn't unjust, you know, and he got with me, and ever since then, we've just been doing everything we can to, you know, see that Rolf gets released. You know, he's 70 years old, you know, and like one of the interview guys I was listening to said, you know, Rolf was probably rehabilitated or whatever when he wrote those letters to me, apologizing. You know, that's, he should have been released not long after that. Should have been released way before that. But to me, when he apologized to me, you know, in the letters, that should have been enough right then. But, you know, it wasn't. And they just kind of buried him, you know, put him down in Utah, and like I said, threw away the key.
That was over 25 years ago when he wrote that letter to you of apology, and it seems like it was sincere contrition. But he's still in prison.
Yes, he's still in prison.
Dennis, now you've tried to reach the governor or the various governors in Arkansas to get some kind of clemency here, but no luck. Why is that?
Well, you know, I really don't know. I made a video talking, you know, pleading with the governor about 7 years ago, you know, and he went up for clemency again about six years ago, and I have no idea why. You know, I still think it has something to do with that scandal, and by then I thought, you know, surely the governor's going to have enough heart to let see that this man's done enough time, but there's something there, you know, that just they refuse. And not to mention, you know, I've heard the governor and the prosecuting attorney here in Sebastian County in Arkansas are good friends. And the prosecuting attorney at that time, he was the one that sent Rolf to prison, and he is good friends with Baxter Hutchinson. Not saying that that has anything to do with it, but, you know, a phone call could be made very easily. You know, don't let this man out, you know, because of various reasons. It's just so not mind-boggling that's just a scenario. And who really knows? I wish the governor would, you know, like another guy said, if the governor says no, he's not going to grant him clemency, I'd like to know why. You know, well,
did Rolf Castell have a rap sheet? I mean, was he a chronic criminal?
He had been convicted before of a few crimes, but it was like a 3-year sentence, so it couldn't have been, you know, too much. You know, the guy's been pretty much on his own all of his life ever since he was a kid, you know, and foster homes and stuff like that, and he's just been, you know, he grew up the way most kids shouldn't grow up, you know, but he did. And I mean, you talk about an intelligent man. I mean, he's got like 4.0 grade average in college. He's got I don't know how many degrees, and he teaches, you know, stuff in while he's been in prison, and he was paralegal for several lawyers in Little Rock when he was in Arkansas prison. And I mean, just a very intelligent man. He even represented himself in the trial, which, you know, if it wasn't for what happened and me pointing out, yeah, he's the man, I think he would have had that case beat. But circumstances come up where the prosecuting attorney had sent one of the guys out that robbed me and to come out and tell me, yeah, we're the ones that did it. You know, I'm sorry, and this is why we did it, and this and that, which then put it in my mind that, yeah, he's the guy that did it.
Dennis, do you feel great remorse or regret today that you know, you actually did finger this Rolf Castell?
Well, I don't feel regret or remorse. Well, in a way, yes, but you know, I did do the right thing. The man did rob me. I feel, you know, sorry for him because of the fact that our justice system is so messed up in keeping people like Rolf in prison. There's, you know, no telling how many others are like that, yeah, you know, that are in prison now for something they shouldn't be in there for. But Rolf, you know, he's 70 years old. I mean, I feel
yeah,
you know,
what purpose does it serve at this point? I mean, understandable.
Exactly. I mean, let the man out, you know, and I'm even going to try to get some kind of a fundraising deal where maybe I can get enough money to give to Ralph when he gets out to be able to enjoy what few years he has left. I mean, he's been in there longer than he's been a free man, you know, 40 years. He was 30 when he went in.
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, it just boggles my mind so bad that this happened to him. It's hard for me to even come up with words.
Yeah. Well, it's bewildering on this end as well. Dennis, I got to let you run, but I appreciate your sharing your story with us and the story of Rolf Castell, who robbed you, albeit back 40 years ago, and he got life plus a $15,000 fine, and he's still in a Utah prison, 40-plus years and counting. He's in his 70s now. Dennis Schluterman, the man who was working as a store clerk that day in 1981 at the age of 17. A story of a guy who's actually taken upon himself this challenge to go and hit a golf ball in every state in the union, I guess in the contiguous 48 states, but he's run afoul of the law. And that happened in, I guess, Yellowstone Park. Jake Adams is a comedian from Massachusetts as well as an avid golfer, and he's joined us here on the Oakley Show to tell us how he got in hot water with the U.S. federal government. Jake, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on. So actually, it was all 50 states, and I took on the challenge in a 30-day window.
Wow, that's remarkable. So you're a road warrior of sorts then. You were really traveling around, doing gigs at the same time?
No, didn't really have time to stop much. Most nights I was driving until I fell asleep. But yeah, it was a pretty amazing journey, and got to see a lot of beautiful parts of this country. I would have loved to come to Canada, but at the time, golf was illegal.
Well, it ought to be. As an avid golfer myself, I get it. You're not allowed to cross the border right now. And we also, in Ontario, had shut down the courses until last week. But you were driving until you fell asleep.
Right.
That, you don't mean actually driving the golf ball. You're behind the wheel now. Asleep at the wheel is what you're saying.
Right. Yeah, there were some definitely long hours, trying to get all 50 states in.
I guess so. Yeah, that's why foolish me thinking you're doing some gigs at the same time. That would be like less than a one-nighter, you're moving from state to state.
Yeah, so yeah, it'd be pretty wild.
You got into trouble, though, with the law. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so I thought I took all the right precautions because, I used a biodegradable golf ball throughout the whole trip. I put it on my Instagram stories from the very beginning. And, I thought that was the right play. But, I went to Yellowstone National Park and hit one of the biodegradable golf balls there. But, I didn't realize the magnitude of hitting a foreign substance, and like how any foreign substance can mess with their ecosystem.
Sure.
Even though it biodegrades in a number of days, I had no idea, that is just an absolute no-no. So definitely had a lot of feedback from people, from locals around that area. And I the case is still pending. I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen. I mean, they've called me and told me what's the maximum fine and penalty. But, I'm just kind of trying to do my part to push the message forward so nobody else makes the same mistake,
Jake Adams, again, comedian and golfer, and really took upon himself this challenge to hit a golf ball in every 50 states of the United States in 30 days. And so at Yellowstone, where you uncorked one, I saw it had a bit of a tail on it. I thought it was a slice. But nonetheless, let me ask you, what are the possible charges here and what are the possible consequences?
I mean, that's just as disrespectful than telling me I might go to jail, I'm more of a drawer of the golf ball, but, it's tough to joke about it. Cause I don't know, they said up to 6 months in jail and a possible $5,000 fine, for hitting this golf ball. I obviously come from, and a lot of people that I know come from a different walk of life where you don't think about how much damage, one golf ball could do to an ecosystem. But I just want to take everybody's consideration in stride and kind of make sure I do the right thing, especially on my future challenges.
Well, okay. I mean, hitting a golf ball in Yellowstone National could cost you 6 months in jail or a $5,000 fine. By the way, who do you think dropped the dime on you here or who ratted you out to the federales?
Well, you know, it got a lot of traction. The journey as a whole is on, you know, Golf Digest and Golf Channel. And I think just a local Yellowstone Instagram page reposted it. And that's kind of when the heat started.
All right. But you're still waiting. Now you're advocating to not despoil the park with any foreign objects, as it were. So even wrestlers reaching into their trunks, you know, don't do that. But the point then, Jake, is you're going to go on with this challenge, though you're taking it transcontinental, aren't you?
Yeah, my plan for next year is I want to do every country in Europe in 30 days. But, you know, obviously take all the right precautions and hit a golf ball in places where I can you know, retrieve them. Even though if they're biodegradable, they make this great biodegradable golf ball. It's from this company, Albus, where if you hit it into water, literally upon impact, it turns into fish food. So I think that's still okay to do in oceans, but obviously stay away from any national park.
It's kind of like mobsters in that regard. Ultimately, they turn into fish food. Jake, this is funny stuff. But, you know, it's a brilliant angle to get your name out there front and center. I mean, comedian slash golfer. And because Golf Digest and the channel and everybody else, and we're talking about it, it's a hook. And now people are more aware with Jake Adams. You can check him out. Google the name, comedian, golfer. Hoping to have you already completed the 50 states, by the way?
Yeah, I did in April.
Okay, all right. So now Europe, on to Europe, and let's win there. Good enough, Jake. Good to talk to you, and thanks for giving us the heads up on the biodegradable golf ball. I got to look into this. Back in the old days of collectibles, I mean, you had things like coins and cards and stamps, and they had some value. Well, they still do. The world's most valuable postage stamp was put on the block just a day or so ago and came up with a surprise number. Surprising for maybe a variety of reasons, but let's find out exactly what this was all about. Joining me on the line is Daniel Piazza. He's the chief curator of the Smithsonian National Postal Museum in Washington, D.C. Daniel, good to have you on the Oakley Show in Toronto. Good afternoon.
Hi, John. Pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. I mean, so here we've got this rather valuable postage stamp. It's the world's most valuable. What is it? Where's it from? Can you describe it for us?
Sure. This is a 1 cent postage stamp that was issued in the former British colony of British Guiana in South America in 1856. And the reason that it's so famous and so well known and sells for such high prices every time that it's offered for auction is that it is the only copy of this particular stamp known to exist. And so a lot of people like to own rare and unique and one-of-a-kind things, and this fits the bill.
All right, and so it went on the auction block, but what was the outcome based on, you know, the projected or anticipated selling price to what it actually realized?
Right. Well, the last time the stamp sold, it sold for just under $10 million U.S. dollars. The estimate that was published in the auction catalog when it was offered for sale this time was a range from $10 to $15 million U.S. dollars, and it sold for just north of $8 million U.S. dollars. So less than was estimated, less than it sold for the last time that it sold, but still enough to keep its title, I guess, as the world's most valuable postage stamp.
All right, but I'm kind of curious because it sold for less than what it was purchased for back, I guess, about 7 years or so ago, from my understanding.
Right.
So philatetics, the collecting of stamps, has it fallen out of favor now? NFTs replacing it? How's that going?
Well, you know, the popularity of stamp collecting among mere mortals, you know, doesn't have terribly much to do with the value of stamps at this level. I think so many things go into it that it's kind of hard to know ultimately why a stamp sells for the price it did. Some of the factors have to do with the stamp itself. Maybe that collecting area of British Guiana or 19th century stamps isn't as popular right now as it has been in the past. Sometimes it has to do with entirely external causes, like, you know, the overall economy. To really get those stratospheric prices, you know, you need to have ideally two or three people with very deep pockets who are really interested in owning the same item, and that's when you get these stratospheric realizations at auction. So it's hard to know at any one moment why a stamp sells for more or less than it did the last time.
Again, Daniel Piazza, chief curator of the Smithsonian National Postal Museum in Washington, D.C. So this stamp was worth 1 cent back in 1856. So realized price, $8.3 million and change yesterday, albeit somewhat less than what it was originally purchased for back in 2014, I believe $9.5 million U.S. Its value is, the inherent value is its rarity, obviously, right? And is there a story accompanying this stamp then?
Yes, I mean, it's the rarity of the object, but it's also the, just the tremendous history that it's had of unusual and sometimes very reclusive owners. It was seized by the French government during World War I as an asset belonging to the enemy, to the German government, and ordered sold to pay war reparations. And then it was shown at the 1939 World's Fair. It was owned very famously by John E. DuPont, who was a very wealthy American collector who then spent the better part of three decades in jail for murder, and he owned the stamp the entire time that he was in jail. So it's had this sort of very long and colorful history of unusual owners, and it also has a tendency to disappear from public view for long periods of time. So until it came to the museum, Stuart Weitzman, who was the previous owner, placed it on long-term loan with the museum for about 5 years. I was privileged to be the stamp's curator while it was at the museum. But until we showed it in our gallery for those 5 years, no one had seen the stamp in public in almost 30 years. So it has a tendency to disappear for long periods of time. And now it's going to have another unusual chapter of its history. Apparently, I read in the press today that it's going to be offered as a non-fungible token, as you were talking about prior to our interview. So that's a first, I'm pretty sure, for a postage stamp. And how that works with a physical artifact, as you were mentioning, you know, in your introduction, most non-fungible tokens are usually some sort of digital asset, a piece of digital artwork, or even famous tweets and videos have been offered as non-fungible tokens. How that's going to work with a physical asset like the 1 cent magenta, I'm not quite sure. But whatever it is, it's going to just add another unusual and quirky chapter to this particular stamp's history.
Yeah, I was going to say, even in the case of Anthony Weiner, I guess you could call it a digital asset, but nonetheless, it's, well, I won't dwell
digital,
on that one.
Digital is hands.
Right. By the way, is there anything else remarkable or spectacular about this 1 cent stamp that, you know, I guess was cobbled together from what I understand on the fly? It was sort of a bridge stamp back in 1856 in British Guyana on the north coast of South America.
Right. Collectors call them provisional stamps. And what that means is all of the stamps that were issued and used in the British colonies in the 19th century, many of them were printed in England and sent out by ship to the colonies to be used in the local post offices. And in 1856, a shipment of stamps to British Guiana didn't arrive on time when it was expected to, and the local postmaster ran out of stamps, went to the local newspaper publisher, and asked him to quickly just use the type and the cuts that he had available in the print shop, and as you say, cobble together this stamp and issue it in a short period of time, just to kind of get them through until the stamps arrived from Great Britain. And so very few of the stamps were printed in the first place, and even fewer of them have survived down to the present day. There was a 1 cent stamp and a 4 cent stamp. There are a few copies of the 4 cent stamp known, but of the 1 cent, only this one copy has ever surfaced.
Yeah, the rarity of this commodity, as it were, I mean, even used as reparations, war reparations from Germany to France back in the post-World War I days. That's remarkable to me that a stamp would have that kind of, well, I don't want to say, but inherent value, I suppose, the world's most valuable postage.
Yeah. The owner of the stamp then was a collector named Ferrari who was living in France. And it was his intention, he willed his stamp collection to the Postal Museum in Berlin. This was around the time before World War I, but then he died during the war. And so when he died, and it became, under the terms of the will, it became the property of the German government, and the French government came in and seized it and said, well, now They impounded it for the duration of the war, and then ordered it sold after the war in partial payment of war reparations.
Well, then finally, Daniel, any idea who bought it yesterday for $8.307 million U.S.?
Oh, yes. I mean, the new owner has been announced. It's a stamp trading company called Stanley Gibbons in the United Kingdom, and they're the ones who are going to offer it as a non-fungible token. So we'll have to this is now not only, I think, a new and interesting chapter in the history of the stamp, but in this sort of craze we're seeing in the art and digital world for collecting and investing this way. I confess that I don't fully understand it myself, but it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds.
Well, absolutely. So we'll keep an eye on this, just where the whole NFT market is taking us. I mean, as again, people say, I don't know, is there inherent value in some of this apart from its rarity or the fact that you can have something unique and claim ownership of it and title to it? That was an interesting insight into the world of philatetics, I guess is what they call it. Daniel Piazza is the chief curator of the Smithsonian National Postal Museum in Washington, D.C. In 1942, the 7th of June, a turning point in history in the Pacific War actually took place. And here to tell us all about that and its significance is Craig L. Simmons. He's a naval historian, professor emeritus at the U.S. Naval Academy, as well as author of the book, The Battle of the Midway. Professor, good to have you on the Oakley Show in Toronto. Good afternoon.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon to you.
I think we can state that rather unequivocally. It was a turning point, certainly, in the war in the Pacific. Tell us how so, and maybe by extrapolating from that, why it was so important historically.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The major part of the battle, the 5 minutes, roughly, from 10:25 in the morning till 10:30 in the morning, on the morning of June 4th, 1942, the Japanese lost 4 aircraft carriers. Well, lost 3, and then a fourth was sent to the bottom that afternoon. But that moment, it's very seldom in history. You can pinpoint a moment when history turned on a pivot, but that was one of those moments. The Japanese were winning the Pacific War. They were winning the Battle of Midway, and then it all flipped in about a 5-minute period. It's really a remarkable moment in history.
They had a greater naval power and presence, and yet the Americans were on the up and come. But it was a case, I won't say it was entirely fortuitous, but tell us then how the Americans turned the tide so rapidly.
Well, there are a couple of parts, ways to answer that question. I think that this key element in all of this is that a group of rather eclectic individuals working in a basement office at the 14th Naval District headquarters in Hawaii had broken just enough of the Japanese operational code that they could predict that the Japanese were going to strike Midway, that they were going to do so with 4 aircraft carriers, and that they were going to do it on about the 3rd or 4th of June in 1942. So armed with that information, the American commander in the Pacific, a fellow named Chester Nimitz, a white-haired, blue-eyed commander of the entire Pacific Fleet, said he was going to take a chance. He was going to take the only 3 aircraft carriers he had, one of which had to be patched up from a recent battle, and send them out to a point 325 miles north of Midway, the last place in the ocean, quite literally, that the Japanese would look for them, and ambush the Japanese as they approached. Absent that code-breaking information, it's not clear how this battle would have gone.
Well, Admiral Yamamoto, the celebrated Japanese admiral who was in charge of the Pacific Fleet at the time, he had it figured out that this was going to be sort of the turning point for the Japanese. Once they decimated the American presence there, Midway would be their staging area. They would control the entire Pacific, would they not?
Well, that was his plan. The idea, Yamamoto, interestingly enough, had been a skeptic about the idea of going to war with the United States. He had spent a lot of time in the United States. He had gone to school at Harvard. He had traveled around. He had seen the depth and breadth of this country and understood that America's industrial capability and their raw material resources gave them an enormous edge. But once it was clear that the decision makers in Tokyo had decided they were going to go to war, he said the only chance we have is to knock the Americans out on the first day. So Pearl Harbor was roughly his idea. Now, the great disappointment to him about Pearl Harbor was, the good news was it devastated the American battleships. The bad news was that it didn't get any of the American carriers. So he put together this plan to attack Midway in order to draw out the American aircraft carriers, pounce on them with a superior force, and send them all to the bottom. And that would give him control of at least the Western Pacific for another 4, 5, 6 months, which would allow the Japanese to perfect their defensive fortifications and defy the Americans to come get them. But, of course, he didn't count on the Americans knowing that he was coming.
Again, Craig L. Simmons is with us, naval historian, professor emeritus at the U.S. Naval Academy, and author of the book, The Battle of the Midway, A Turning Point in the War in the Pacific, on this date. It ended June 7th, 1942. You know, further to the point, when they were, I guess, maneuvering or positioning themselves, Nimitz, to the northeast, the Japanese, again, if I recall, sent a fake force out to the Aleutian Islands, Alaska. They actually made, I guess, a land, American property there in the Aleutians, but that was all just a feint, wasn't it?
Well, it's often been interpreted that way. They did it at the same time, and it wasn't clear at the time whether they hoped that that would distract the Americans from the real goal, which was to get the American carriers, or if this was simply another manifestation of their seizure of barrier islands that would protect their island empire from an American offensive. And it seems now, having access to Japanese archives, that it was more that they were going to take the Aleutians anyway, and it happened to be taking place pretty much at the same time. But in any case, because of the code breakers, Admiral Nimitz was not confused by that. He did send a couple of cruisers and several destroyers up to the Aleutian Islands to defend those. He felt an obligation that since it was American territory, he was required to defend it, but he kept all his carriers, which were the ones that really counted, to defend Midway.
Now, was it a true story or apocryphal that, and I'm wondering if in the movie I saw this correctly, Yamamoto, you know, after the Battle of Midway and losing, he said, oh no, we've awakened a sleeping giant, or was that at Pearl Harbor?
Well, it was probably following Pearl Harbor, but he knew that beforehand. I mean, he knew it would awake a sleeping giant. He fought against the Japanese high command to initiate this war. Remember that the Japanese goal in this war is not to defeat the United States or the Allied forces generally. The Japanese goal was to get access to the raw materials and especially the oil of the Dutch East Indies and Malaya and Indonesia, the Dutch East Indies, and Indochina. And the fear was that the United States would respond if the Japanese tried to seize those areas. So Pearl Harbor was sort of to knock America back on its heels, gobble up those valuable resources in the South Pacific, and then hold out against an American counterattack until the Americans, whom the Japanese thought were feckless and impatient, till the Americans decided, oh, this is too much trouble, it's too expensive, it's too costly, never mind. The problem for the Japanese, of course, is that by initiating the war the way they did in attacking Pearl Harbor, it did awake that sleeping giant. And therefore, the Americans never got to the point where they said, oh, this is too costly, this is too hard.
Right. And it obviously were, that was their imperial ambition, and it never really was fulfilled, as we've seen historically. So in the end, the Battle of Midway ended today on this date, 42. Can you say comparatively what the losses were in that battle, Americans versus the Japanese?
Yeah, I sure can. The Japanese, by the time the battle was over, lost all four of the carriers they had sent. Now, remember, their carrier force of six carriers, that's what attacked Pearl Harbor, six aircraft carriers, those are their big carriers, and they lost four of them in this one battle. The United States lost one, and the one that it lost was the Yorktown, which had already been crippled in the previous Battle of the Coral Sea. So while the Japanese were clearly the dominant, preeminent power on June 3rd, by June 7th, by this date, the United States had seized the initiative, and the United States would be the side that decided where the next campaign would be, where it would be initiated, and the Japanese had lost control of the direction of the war.
A pivotal point in the Pacific and the war itself. Professor, really great to talk and have this all put into context. A reminder, your book, Decision at Sea, Five Naval Battles That Shaped American History. Certainly, it's a prize winner, would be considered here. The Battle of Midway certainly would be one such. Craig Simmons, naval historian, professor emeritus at the U.S. Naval Academy. That's a wrap for the Oakley Show podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Turn the dial to 640. Listen live at 640toronto.com or search the name John Oakley on Spotify.
Thanks for listening to the John Oakley Show podcast. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you get your on-demand audio.